This program may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Coming up next on Homeland Security Inside and Out, boy, do we have a full plate. We'll start with a guest from Mexico City talking about how the drug trade has become a part of the social fabric south of our border. A researcher from RAND will give us the global state of play for Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups, followed by stories about identification cards and identifying hostile agents inside your organization. We'll hear the results and the recommendations from a scientific study on school shootings, and we'll talk with researchers about what we can learn from the differences in how Houston evacuated ahead of Hurricane Rita versus ahead of Hurricane Ike 3 years later. And we'll talk with the director of the leading federal-level Homeland Security Education Program at the Naval Postgraduate School in California. So stay with us for a full serving of Homeland Security Inside and Out. Welcome to Homeland Security Inside and Out. I'm Dave McIntyre from the Integrative Center for Homeland Security at Texas A&M University. Leading off on Homeland Security Inside and Out is Tracy Wilkerson, the staff writer and the Mexico Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Tracy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And you're joining us from where?
Mexico City.
Tracy, you wrote a distressing story recently in the LA Times where the thrust was that these drug cartels are perhaps not the way we think of them. You talked about how they're woven into the society in Mexico. Would you explain that for our listeners?
Well, the story was about Monterrey, Mexico's wealthiest industrial city up in the north, and the significance of what happened there is that the drug traffickers are able to mobilize people in the community. They are very much part of the community in some parts of Monterrey and other parts of Mexico as well. And what we saw happening in Monterrey is that they were able to get people into the streets to protest against the government and the army. They did so paying them, but that's almost beside the point. The point was they could really give this show of force, and it's a different aspect of the power of the traffickers that is very disturbing.
Well, first, just what happened. We have now seen several protests along the border against the military, ostensibly against military overreaction, over control, rough handling, and some of that may be true. Let's face it, anytime a military cracks down in an area, there's always going to be some clash. But there is significant suspicion this was generated by drug traffickers almost as a sort of information warfare. Is that right?
Correct. A kind of propaganda. They try to make it look as though the people were rebelling against the army. As you know, President Calderon of Mexico has deployed the army in many parts of Mexico to fight the traffickers, to try to put down the violence, to try to end the rampant murders in parts of the country. And so what the traffickers have done in some cases is try to show that the people are against it. And what they did in Monterrey and other cities closer to the border was pay people to go into the streets and demonstrate. I mean, yes, there are legitimate grievances in some areas against the army. Obviously, an army can be heavy-handed. But generally, the surveys show that most Mexicans favor the army coming in if it means restoring security, because Mexicans are afraid. They've seen that murder rates, kidnapping rates are sky-high in many parts of Mexico, and so they initially at least approve of the military coming in. It does restore security, at least temporarily. That obviously is a big problem for the traffickers who don't want the army in their territory, and so they try to generate this impression that the people are against it by mobilizing these demonstrations.
Tracy, I just have about a minute left, but you also suggested something else in the article I'd never thought about before, and that is that this has kind of woven its way into life. I mean, this is just not some disaffected, unemployed youth that are part of the cartel. I mean, mom's packing them a lunch, and the 10-year-old's working as a lookout. The families are involved. That's a distressing thought.
In some parts of Mexico, that is certainly the case, and it is distressing. In the case of Monterrey, this was an area, a neighborhood in Monterrey where for generations, people have been involved in some form of small-scale trafficking. And what has happened is the more vicious, ruthless cartel members and their paramilitary squads have moved in and just sort of woven themselves into that, sort of co-opted that business and become part of that community.
Well, it was a great story. Mexico drug cartels are buying public support, by Tracy Wilkerson in the L.A. Times. Tracy is the Mexico bureau chief for L.A. Times, and thank you, Tracy, for being with us.
Thank you.
Now Seth Jones is with us on Homeland Security Inside and Out. He's a political scientist at RAND Corporation and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service in Washington, D.C. Thanks very much, Seth, for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Seth, I heard you do a presentation recently. I was at the Homeland Security and Defense Education Consortium meeting at George Washington University there in D.C., and you were on a panel, gave what I thought was just an outstanding laydown and discussion of sort of the current status of terrorism globally and its implications for here in the United States. It did a great job. How about start from the top and give us those thoughts again, would you?
Sure. I think the United States in general is facing a range of different terrorist threats to the homeland. But I think the one that U.S. intelligence agencies have identified primarily are coming from the Afghan-Pakistan border areas, especially on the Pakistan side. There's an arc that moves from the northwest frontier province south through Pakistan's federally administered tribal areas and into the Balochistan province of Pakistan, and actually into a range of Pakistani cities where you have a whole range of mostly, though not entirely, Sunni militant groups from the Afghan Taliban through the Haqqani network, through a range of Uzbek militant groups, including the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, and a range of other groups focusing on Kashmir. And what al-Qaeda has done in these areas is embed itself into areas controlled by a range of these different militant groups. And in these areas, what we see is, whether it's Osama bin Laden or in particular his deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, or a range of others, including Abu al-Yazid, we see al-Qaeda training camps have emerged, information operations have emerged. They're conducting, for example, a whole range of clandestine efforts via their al-Sahab media network, improving their ability to conduct suicide attacks, trying to recruit people over the internet, and then get in touch with a range of networks operating in Europe, in Asia, in North Africa, including Somalia now, and other parts of the globe. And so we see an effort to target a range of governments in North Africa, the Middle East, and into South Asia, as well as Western countries, especially the United States, that are supporting them. So, again, what I'm talking about is really an al-Qaeda threat to the U.S. homeland emanating from this area of Pakistan that's linked in with a range of local and other international jihadi groups.
So you're not talking about there's this gigantic 10-foot-tall al-Qaeda in numbers of thousands. You're talking about almost a political force that's insinuated itself into local arguments and complaints and problems to build a network.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. In fact, one could conceive of al-Qaeda as being in sort of four dimensions. The first is what you might call core or central al-Qaeda. That's a very small number of individuals, tend to be at senior leadership levels. Then you get an outer ring of actual militant groups, clear organizations that they have embedded themselves into. In the Afghan front, they would include the Afghan Taliban, led by Mullah Muhammad Omar. Then you have an outer ring of networks across the globe. Those would be individuals like in 2005, in July 2005, the attacks in London, the Mohammed Siddiqui Khan network, almost local grassroots organizations that they've linked into. And then a fourth outer ring would be simply people who are inspired to conduct attacks by al-Qaeda, but actually no direct connection. So the actual numbers of those inner or core elements are fairly small.
Seth, it sounds like this type of organization couldn't exist before the internet. Is that correct?
Well, I think the internet certainly helps out quite a bit. I mean, the organization did exist before the internet, but the internet does help in a range of ways. One is it's helpful for reaching out to the ummah across the globe in trying to lure people and recruit them through a range of ways, by showing them images of, for example, U.S. forces operating in a range of places, Abu Ghraib, a whole range of efforts on the Internet that they can use for recruitment purposes. It's also helpful. They'll take video cameras onto the battlefield in Pakistan or Afghanistan, film footage of targeting U.S. forces or other forces on the ground, improvised explosive devices or other suicide attacks, for example, bring it back, show it on the Internet or put it on CDs and try to demonstrate that they actually are conducting jihad against the infidels. So the Internet is clearly a way to contact people around the globe, also for funding purposes as well, to show and teach people how to better put together improvised explosive devices and improve their tactics, techniques, and procedures. Could they do it without the Internet? Possibly, but it certainly is incredibly helpful.
So what's the actual danger? Is there a way to feel that? I mean, it's one thing to say we have thousands of people linked together. It's a different thing. So does the Catholic Church. It's a different thing to say, we have thousands or hundreds of people in training who pose a potential threat against the United States. Not
sure.
The same thing. What do you think?
Just to illustrate with a couple of cases, I think that there are a couple of dangers. One is from Americans or other individuals which have access to the United States through, for example, the visa waiver program. So, for example, there are concerns. Britain's MI5, its domestic intelligence agency, has identified publicly over 2,000 threats to the UK from al-Qaeda in general, partly among its Pakistani community, which would have access to the United States because of the visa waiver program. So the argument here is that individuals can go through training in Pakistan, and this is important both from an ideological perspective. I think it tends to hearten people's ideological commitment to conduct a suicide attack, which takes a great deal, for example, of inner fortitude to actually go out on one's own and blow oneself up. Second, it does improve tactics, techniques, and procedures. So use of hydrogen peroxide, for example, and the formulas for doing it were very important in what we saw in 2006 in what was called the transatlantic plot. And so what we saw there is British radicals planning from the UK an attack against planes leaving the UK and going to the United States, and it was going to blow them up en route from Europe to the United States through, in particular in this case, hydrogen peroxide put into Gatorade bottles. So, but the ability to get access to these locations for training is actually quite fundamental, and we've seen, including in 2006, very serious and potential, in this case, thwarted threats from these individuals.
Seth, we just have 1 minute left, but I recently heard Secretary Chertoff respond to a question. It was what keeps him awake at night, and he said nuclear and biological terrorism. This organization you described to us, do you think they have those capabilities?
Well, we certainly know that over the last decade that al-Qaeda has been interested in nuclear capabilities. It's talked to elements of the AQ Khan network operating in Pakistan. It has done some limited chemical and biological lab experiments. As to its actual capability to conduct an attack in the United States, that's certainly an open question, but it has expressed an interest in some at least limited capabilities.
Seth, thanks for being with us. We've been talking with Seth Jones, who's a political scientist at the RAND Corporation and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service, and gave us an excellent overview of sort of the state of the play of a very adaptive enemy. Thank you, Seth, for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. We're going to talk about Real ID and the unseen war in Iraq coming up next on Homeland Security, Inside and Out. Why does it seem we always have distressing stories from the media on Homeland Security Inside and Out? Well, the next one distresses me. Jill Itoro is a senior reporter for Government Executive Magazine and for NextGov.com, NextGov.com. Jill, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, your story that upset me said it's back to the drawing board for Real ID.
Yeah, and just to clarify, too, this is a blog that we posted based on a few comments from the DHS secretary, Napolitano.
Well, tell us what is Real ID for anybody out there who has been had their radio off for the last 7 years.
Well, in 2005, a law was passed known as Real ID, which basically requires all states to issue ID cards, basically driver's license, that meet standards set by the federal government for security.
Okay. Does this mean that every state would have to issue exactly the same driver's license?
No, it doesn't. And it basically means that it's up to the state to issue the driver's license and the form of the driver's license. There was just a series of specific requirements that they would have to comply with, that everything from, oh, goodness, certain information included, certain personal information and
picture
so forth.
ID. Picture ID,
yep. There's talk going back and forth about some biometric information as well, but that was always debated.
Was there a requirement that there be a single national database where everybody was going to be collected, so this would be like a national ID card?
I believe the requirement that was initially called for was that the information be able to be exchanged.
So a state could query another state, but there wouldn't be a federal database.
Right, and one other key factor was that little logistical things, like the picture be taken before the information was provided, so that if someone was refused an ID in one state, that picture is in the database for other states to see and know, okay, this person was refused already, and can then inquire as to why.
And if somebody had a driver's license in more than one state, we'd know that, wouldn't we?
Yes, exactly.
So your blog is essentially that the Secretary of Homeland Security is going to call a halt to it.
She go as far to say drastically change what is in that law. She, as the governor of Arizona, was always pretty vocal about having issues with this, along with many other states who basically felt it was an unfunded mandate, a requirement that didn't have the necessary money behind it to help states comply. So that was one big issue. And then, of course, there's always the privacy issue that people bring up. But she's been a pretty vocal person that wanted some changes made to this, and I believe she's going to do that.
Jill, you cover IT issues for Government Executive Magazine.
I do.
In your opinion, is there a serious identity issue? Are identity cards like this easy to get false identities?
Licenses are currently, there is an issue. And frankly, I think Napolitano would say that there's an issue. The fact that going back to 9/11 even, they were able to get driver's license and be licensed to fly has always been brought up as a good example. I think the fact that these are run by states is not inappropriate, but by the same means, there needs to be adjustments so that we can better ensure the people who get these cards are who they say they are and that they don't pose a national threat. So, yeah, there definitely needs to be changes. Whether Real ID was the right one is not for me to say, but I do believe the universal opinion is that some changes need to be made to ensure security.
I appreciate your keeping us apprised with stories like this. Jill Itoro is a senior reporter for Government Executive Magazine. You can find that at nextgov.com, nextgov.com. Thanks, Jill, for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Next up on Homeland Security Inside and Out, The Unseen War in Iraq, a new book about the insurgents in the shadows. And the author is Rick Saccone, who is a retired Air Force captain, served as counterintelligence consultant in Iraq, and currently teaches international relations at St. Vincent College in Pennsylvania. Rick, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
What was unseen about the war in Iraq? What specifically are you focused on?
I'm really trying to give the reader a sense of what it's like to get intelligence information from an insurgent, from an enemy, and what the interrogation process is like and what the treatment of prisoners is like. Because when I came back from Iraq, I found there were a lot of media-driven misperceptions about how we do all this. So that's what the book focuses on.
You kind of break the war into what you call the war outside the wire and the war inside the wire, the idea being everybody thinks about leaving base camp, going on patrol, capturing people, being shot at, being wounded. But there is a whole separate set of things that continue the war once friendly and enemy return to inside the wire, aren't there?
Exactly. I mean, it's more exciting to talk about the war outside the wire. That's what we live for. That's what all the old movies are about, the shoot 'em up, the raids, all that type of thing. But inside the wire, it's a different story. It's more of a cloak and dagger type of operation where we're trying to catch those people who are infiltrating, try to get on our good side, and at the same time do us in our most safe place, our safe haven, our homes, or the bases that we're assigned to.
Let me ask first about interrogations. Did you take part in interrogations?
Yes. We regularly had the first shot at people brought in, so to speak, when they were brought in from patrol, if they were brought in as a prisoner, depending where I was. I usually had the first chance to talk to them.
Well, Rick, obviously there's a lot of controversy about things like torture and things like that. I have debated Jonathan Turley on numerous occasions from professor, law professor here in the D.C. area. He thinks if we captured Osama bin Laden, we should read him his rights and give him a lawyer and tell him to remain silent. Where is it between waterboarding and reading them their rights? And what really works? Some people say if you're nice to them, it really they talk to you. What's your opinion?
Yeah, it really boils down to this idea of the difference between coercive and non-coercive techniques. And it's not an either-or. I want to be clear about that. There are people that are committed to one or the other, and any good interrogator must have a number of tools in his tool bag, and they should include both non-coercive and coercive techniques. There are those like Osama bin Laden, probably, but other people like Abu Zubaydah, for example, who are trained to resist interrogation. And those people aren't going to give up information with a nice guy approach, with the approach that, for example, I can help you get out of here, or if we work together, I might get your sentence softened or whatever. Those people are going to resist that, and they are ones that are more likely to need some coercive persuasion.
What do you mean by coercive persuasion?
Yeah, that's a great question, because this whole debate about torture and coercion and non-coercion depends on the definition of torture. I say in my book that I'm not for torture. I'm not a proponent of torture, but I am one of coercive interrogation. And we had a definition for torture which included maiming, amputations, scarring, mutilation, burning, humiliation. Those type of things were classified as torture at one time. And other techniques below that threshold were classified as coercive, for example, putting stress positions, near kneeling, putting the suspect in a chair with one leg shorter than the others just to keep him off balance or make him uncomfortable, sleep deprivation, light and dark manipulation, playing of music, ruses, trickery, dealing with phobias that the person might have, even yelling at the person would be a non-coercive or a coercive type of
Are those techniques, Rick, in the new Army manual?
No, my understanding is that these techniques have all been done away with. There may be some special provision somewhere I don't know about, but my understanding of this is they've gone back to using direct questioning and non-coercive techniques without special circumstances that aren't well defined.
Well, what is it you recommend in your book?
I recommend that the law be changed and our policies reflect the fact that there are times when we need to use coercive techniques, and we should be allowed to use them, even if there are limitations on when, that we should be allowed to use them when the circumstance presents itself. Obviously, we start with non-coercive techniques. If you ask a person direct questions and he's willing to cooperate, or if you can persuade him to cooperate using non-coercive techniques, that's fine. And if you have the time to do it, some people say, well, there are no ticking time bomb scenarios, for example. And I say, well, they're wrong. There are plenty of those types of scenarios where information is perishable, and making nice with the suspect is not going to get you the answer in the time you need it. And I also think it's important that we look at the difference between what I call tactical or field interrogations as opposed to strategic interrogations, where if you're back in a prison environment where you have a lot of time, the prisoner's going nowhere, he probably has information that's not so perishable anymore. You can spend more time discussing things and developing a relationship, developing that rapport. But if you're on the front lines and you're trying to find out where are the other five IEDs that the guy planted when you caught him planting the first one, you don't have time. Someone might get hurt. Someone might get killed. And if he's not cooperating, you might need to use some coercive techniques to get that information.
The subject is counterintelligence. The book is The Unseen War in Iraq, and the author is Rick Saccone. Rick, let me see. We've got only about 3 minutes left. Let me see if we can transition this to a Homeland Security setting. What did you learn about the subject of counterintelligence, not just interrogation, but in finding people who had penetrated your system? What did you learn that might be applied here within the United States?
All of these things are applicable to Homeland Security. First of all, you need a good defensive counterintelligence program, and that starts with the screening of employees. That could be in a business. Local businesses need to screen their employees well. They need to do good background checks. They need to check sources. They need to develop sources, not just the sources that people give them on their applications, but develop sources from that, just like the Department of Defense does. They need to check for foreign contacts and foreign travel. That's the screening of employees, and that's important. That's a fundamental. And fundamentals are important because people like to neglect the basics, looking for a magic shortcut to find out how they're going to solve these problems. But you have to do the groundwork. Next, you need to educate your employees. And employees in any business, these commercial entities, need to know that they need to remain alert to threats and be able to have a mechanism to report it to their superiors. And you have to have a relationship between law enforcement and the community and the commercial entity so that people in those businesses, once they get this information, will be able to pass it to law enforcement so they can act on it.
Rick, have you consulted with anybody, talked to anybody here domestically about your lessons?
I've written a couple of articles that are out there. Since I spent a lot of time writing the book, and since the book has come out, I've spent time promoting the book. So I haven't, since that's been written, other than writing things and trying to get them published, I haven't done any more consulting locally. But I used to be a security consultant, a commercial security consultant, so I know these things apply and how they will help, especially when companies have more than one affiliate. Maybe they operate overseas where they're more vulnerable to intelligence gathering and so forth, or their executives may need special protections. These methods that I'm talking about here are certainly applicable to those situations also.
Well, the reason I ask is I have only 30 seconds left, but one of your recommendations is that counterintelligence officers really need a stronger law enforcement background, and so it seems to me that is something domestic law enforcement ought to be interested in.
Absolutely. The idea of the criminal and the terrorist, these things overlap, and law enforcement authorities have a good investigative sense, whereas intelligence-gathering people really don't. And you need to be able to do the gumshoe work of going out and verifying things and digging up leads. That comes from a good criminal law enforcement type background, and that helps a lot in the counterterrorist and counterintelligence areas.
Rick Saccone teaches international relations at St. Vincent College in Pennsylvania. His new book is The Unseen War in Iraq, Insurgents in the Shadows. Thanks, Rick, for being with us.
Thank you.
There's more still coming up on Homeland Security, Inside and Out.
This is Alyssa Stevens of the Integrative Center for Homeland Security at Texas A&M University. This Research Minute is brought to you by the George Bush School of Government and Public Service and its Master's Program in Homeland Security. Our website is homelandsecurity.tamu.edu. Today we focus on the Naval Postgraduate School. At NPS, research is conducted in every academic department, within the graduate schools, and in the research and education institutes. NPS provides independent assessments of proposed solutions to military issues, pre-deployment evaluation of new technologies, and combined student-faculty expertise for current research and development programs. Visitors to their website may access a variety of publications, thesis abstracts, and featured projects in their research showcase. Visit nps.edu to find this and more. This has been Alyssa Stevens of the Integrative Center for Homeland Security with your Research Minute.
Shot a cocaine and I shot my woman down. Went right home and went to bed. I stuck at loving 44 beneath my head. Got up next morning and I grabbed that gun. Took a shot of cocaine and away.
Well, today's spotlight segment from Homeland Security Inside and Out is drawn right from the pages of today's news. We're going to be talking with Kathleen Newman, who's a professor of sociology and public affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. She's also the director of the Princeton Institute for International and Regional Studies, as well as the director of the doctoral program in social policy, and the author of a new book, Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. Wow, Kathleen, thanks for being with us.
I'm delighted.
I'm sure you've had a lot of interest, given all that's been going on recently with shootings. But by rampage, you mean something very specific. This is just not another in the long line of shootings reported in the news. What's a rampage?
That's right. We try to distinguish this from other kinds of shootings. A rampage shooting in a high school involves someone who's a part of the institution or a former member. So it can't be a drive-by shooting by a stranger. It involves a random element. That is, the shooters often don't know who they've killed or hurt at all until after the fact. So it's not a targeted attack of one protagonist against another. And it has to have these elements of multiple injuries or homicides as well. And so those are the main factors. And that would distinguish it, as I said, from a drive-by shooting or an argument between two people that spills over into the school, or a random attack that has nothing to do with the school itself.
Now, Kathleen, this is just not a personal interest that you had. This was a government-funded study, wasn't it?
Yes, in 1999, Congress passed the Missing, Runaway, and Exploited Children's Act, and it mandated this research project, which was conducted under the auspices of the National Academy of Sciences.
Now, you looked at two specific school shootings. Tell us about the incidents and what happened.
We looked at all school shootings that had occurred since 1970, but focused specifically on two incidents, one that occurred in the Westside Middle School in Westside, Arkansas. It involved two boys, ages 11 and 13, who pulled a fire alarm, which sent all of the children in the middle school out onto a playground in front of the gymnasium. And the boys had positioned themselves on a hillside up above the playground, and they shot down with high-powered rifles down into this bowl and killed four children and a teacher and wounded many others.
What were their ages?
They were 11 and 13 at the time. The other incident was in Heath High School near Paducah, Kentucky, and it involved a 14-year-old freshman who came into the lobby of the high school on a Monday morning after Thanksgiving and unloaded a shotgun into a prayer group that had assembled there, as it did every morning before school began, and killed three kids.
And his age at the time?
He was 14.
14. Catherine, as you worked through your conclusions, you came to five conditions that I think you said were necessary but not sufficient. In other words, just because you have them all doesn't mean a shooting happens. But if any one of these doesn't take place, then the event doesn't occur. Would you review those for us?
There were five conditions common to all of the events we looked at. First, the shooter was suffering from forms of mental illness, often undetected at the time. Second, there was a failure of surveillance, that is, the normal mechanisms that might have picked up on a plot in the making failed in some important way. Third, that there was a script or a plan, a kind of cultural knowledge of shootings as a way of redefining their social persona. So there's a kind of understood pathway by which you become an anti-hero, and that is the pathway they were following. Fourth, there has to be some form of access to guns, almost by definition. And fifth, there has to be a feeling of social marginality and social failure, although not as a loner. The shooters are not loners, and they're not acting spontaneously. These are two mistakes often made in the media. They plan what they're going to do, often for a very long time, and their experience is often a failed joining. So they have a very friction-laden social life.
You really had a number of elements as you begin to unwrap their lives that I would not have expected. One of them rode to school with his sister. His sister didn't pick up there was a problem.
No, he had what he called his English project in the trunk of the car, which was a bunch of guns wrapped up in a blanket. And she had no idea. No one in the family had any idea of what he had in mind. However, there were peers who knew. There were people who did not come to school that Monday morning because they were afraid of what was going to happen. And this is characteristic of school shooters. They're seeking attention, and they gather it by letting out sort of warnings and glimpses of their intentions, often very shrouded and difficult to interpret, but clear enough for some people not to come to school on Monday morning.
You know, this is common. I do a lot of research in this area, workplace violence.
Mm-hmm.
And this is common over and over, not just in schools. After an event takes place, people say, oh, yeah, you didn't know about that? The supervisor, why? I wonder why they didn't do something about that.
Yes, it's very common. And in this respect, rampage shootings in schools and rampages in workplaces are close cousins, if you will.
Let's talk about some solutions then. And one of those solutions is somebody should have said something to me, don't you think?
Yes. What we're interested in is why it is that people don't say something and why it is that young kids don't come forward when they have this information. There's a whole chapter of the book about this. And basically the point is that kids don't think adults are going to take them seriously, or they think what they have to say will not be kept confidential. And because there's enough ambiguity in what they've heard in these threats, that's a very high social cost for them to come forward under these ambiguous conditions. And so they tend not to. In one case we looked at in Alaska, the young man called 20 people the night before and told them exactly where to assemble to watch. And not a single kid came forward to any adult.
Now, see, an outsider like me would look at that and say, what horrible behavior on their part. But what you're suggesting is we need to get below that and understand that the organization, which, and really the individual striking at the organization has got to fix this problem way before it starts to happen by inculcating in those students, in every student, an idea that they have responsibility to say something, they'll be listened to, and they'll be treated responsibly if they do say something.
Exactly. In fact, that is absolutely critical to prevention, making sure that kids who hear threats feel comfortable coming forward, know that the information will be acted on, treated confidentially, because they are really our best bet for an early warning system.
Now, there were several other things that really got my attention in the book. One was that clearly somebody should have seen that these children were at risk. I mean, you had one of the shooters had been repeatedly sexually abused, his brother had been repeatedly sexually abused, and apparently nobody noticed it in the family. What other things would you take away about
that? Is true, but it's very important to note that school shooters come from many different backgrounds. Not all of them, in fact, not even close to all of them, come from backgrounds that dysfunctional. Michael Carneal, the shooter in Kentucky, came from a two-parent family. The father was a lawyer. The mother was a very well-educated homemaker. Absolutely no sign of that kind of trouble. So we can't really profile these kids and expect to identify who will become a shooter. And yet we are often looking for the kid from the dysfunctional family background, and we overlook everybody else because we think we know what kind of person will become a shooter, and we don't.
We got about a minute left. What other major lessons do you want to suggest to our listeners?
We think it's very important for schools to avoid zero tolerance policies for speech. We certainly think it's important to have zero tolerance for weapons. But what happens when you invoke zero tolerance for comments is that kids just clam up and don't come forward with information because they're worried they'll get someone in trouble because of an offhanded comment that usually means nothing. So we advocate a more nuanced approach in order to keep that information pipeline moving. That's really our most important point. Second, it's been very effective to have school resource officers in schools, that is, people who report into the criminal justice system and are seen by the kids as independent of the school system. They seem to feel more comfortable coming forward to people like that. We think it's really critical for rural communities, isolated rural communities, where this typically is the location of school shootings, to entertain the possibility of having teachers who are a little bit oddball here and there, a little bit of a round peg in a square hole. Kids are more comfortable coming forward to someone who's a little bit different sometimes.
Well, I hear a lot to the idea of see something, say something. I hear that spoken about. And what I took away from this book is it does you no good to have that logo, that saying, if you haven't established a culture in which people feel like they can say something and they'll be treated responsibly if they do.
That really makes a very big difference. It's also very important to remind kids, sadly, that these incidents do happen. Because while Columbine, coming up on the 10th anniversary, is very vivid in our minds, it's ancient history to kids who were only a couple years old when it happened.
The author is Catherine Newman, a professor of sociology and public affairs at Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, and the book is Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. Thank you, Catherine, for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And stay with us for more on Homeland Security Inside and Out. Well, time for Just One Thing on Homeland Security Inside and Out, and Robert Stein is going to talk to us tonight on that Just One Thing. He is the Lena Goldman Fox Professor at Rice University, who is an expert on urban politics and public policy. Robert, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
The Just One Thing I'd like to talk about is the study you just completed comparing the experiences of Harris County residents, that's Houston, Texas, during Hurricane Rita and Hurricane Ike. So tell us how'd that come about and what did we find out?
Well, we originally started the project, of course, when Hurricane Katrina hit, of course, New Orleans. And then shortly after that, we were asked by one of the local newspapers, the Houston Chronicle, if we would study evacuation behavior and experiences of Harris County and regional residents to, of course, Hurricane Rita. So we did that, and we're just intrigued by how people made decisions. We worked with several faculty at Texas A&M, at the Texas Transportation Institute, and the other faculty up there who were doing similar work. And then, of course, we, as always, academics, continue that research interest, and I started collaborating with some engineers on the idea of how people perceive risk and how they respond to risk, and what are the differences between perceptions of risk and real risk from all kinds of things that, of course, severe weather like hurricanes can provide. When Ike came along, we were anticipating another hurricane season, but not another hurricane. And we had funding from the National Science Foundation and the City of Houston's Office of Emergency Management. And the rest is, as in our report, we started looking at how do people make decisions about things that they experience intermittently that are never the same.
For our listeners, might not be a big deal where you are. This was a huge issue where I live. We moved more than 500,000 people out of Houston right up the highway past where I live for Rita, and then we did some of that again for Ike. So what'd you learn?
Of course, the two hurricanes are never the same. So Rita was, of course, a hurricane that was a Category 4 that never hit us, but people wouldn't have known that until afterwards. And, of course, they anticipated the devastation of surge and flood and, of course, wind damage and evacuated. And as I'm sure you know now, something in the area of 2 million households evacuated, which, of course, put a tremendous strain on the roadways and created what we sometimes call a secondary disaster. The hurricane, of course, never hit, but the real disaster was the congestion, the gridlock, and tragically, deaths of upwards of about 24 people. Some, of course, were killed in very tragic circumstances because of roadway congestion, and they aren't able to get the kind of medical care they needed. This Hurricane Ike saw only one-third of the households that we surveyed, again, attempted to evacuate, and in part because, of course, it was a Category 2. There, the perceived threat from surge and flood was far less than was the perception of wind damage, which, of course, proved to be the most critical in the loss of power. But here's what we did learn, I think the sort of the bottom line. Had we had a Category 4 hurricane, we would have been in the same position that we were with Rita. That is, there does not seem to be a lot of learning among the residential population of Harris County about whether and how to evacuate. Obviously, preventing someone from evacuating is difficult. That is to say, if people want to go and they're fearful, it's going to be very difficult for public officials to persuade them otherwise or prevent them otherwise. But clearly, where the emergency managers have a lot of discretion is in the timing and the distribution of evacuees. And here again, we found that evacuees from inside and outside designated areas for evacuation, surge and flood areas, behaved in an almost identical manner. They all left too late, and they would have congested the roadways had the absolute volume or proportion of households that evacuated were on par with Rita. We're particularly interested in how people make those decisions, and particularly who they listen to. Where do they get the information that they process to make decisions about both evacuating, how and when and where to evacuate, and I might even add to this the kinds of preparations that people make who don't evacuate. And we're finding these very, very curious sources of information, and it's like everything in life, it's more complicated. No one source of information fits everyone. People inside and outside evacuation zones, people with and without high perceived risk, rely on very different sources of information, ranging from television weathermen to elected officials to friends and neighbors and to social networks that they acquire, whether they be in their apartment complex or in their neighborhood. So that's the kind of work we're doing and trying to figure that out so that we can make recommendations to Office of Emergency Management about how they set up their information campaigns.
Well, so what's the big takeaway that I need to learn from this, Robert? Does that mean emergency managers have to start every time from scratch?
Not necessarily start from scratch. One of the things we're doing is trying to give citizens as much information in a timely fashion. We're working on setting up websites. The key story here is that no two hurricanes are ever alike and that people have diverse sets of fears or risks, and they have diverse sets of information sources. And emergency planners have to be prepared to be able to address that diversity. It's not hard, particularly in a technological age, but you cannot assume that what lessons are learned from a previous hurricane, particularly for residents, not managers, but for residents, will carry over to the next.
Fascinating study, a comparison of the experiences of Harris County residents during Hurricanes Rita and Ike. Robert Stein and his team did the research. He's the Lena Goldman Fox Professor at Rice University. Thanks, Robert, for being with us.
My pleasure. You have a nice day.
Well, Randy, time for perspectives here on Homeland Security Inside and Out. Where you been? What have you been doing? And what's important?
Well, I recently attended a little workshop over at DARPA, and Secretary Chertoff was the speaker. He came to talk about the bio threat. Now, it was not for attribution, so I can't say any specifics about it. But what I can say is we had a huge collection of biosecurity specialists in the room, and we virtually everyone I talked to was so impressed about the depth of knowledge that Secretary Chertoff had about the bio issue. There's a lot of leaders in this town that nod their head and say, oh, yeah, bio, that's a threat. But they don't really have any depth of understanding. He demonstrated an extraordinary depth of understanding about the key issues. And the good news is I talked to him, and he has agreed to be on our show for an extended interview here in the not-too-distant future to talk about looking back on his days as the secretary, what he sees as the challenges ahead, and what he's doing out in the private sector right now. So we're really looking forward to that. What have you been looking at, Dave?
Well, first let me mention to our listeners that we will also be bringing in members of the administration, but we got to get them in their chairs first. And so they're still, still getting qualified by the Senate. Once they're in the chairs, we will bring them in. Randy, I think what I'd like to do for just the next minute or so is just touch on the new counterinsurgency strategy for Pakistan and Afghanistan. You and I have been teaching strategy for each of us about 20 years or more. We have come to Homeland Security sort of through that, sort of backed into it from a national security perspective. And so I must say, I don't want to comment on it. I don't want to criticize it. I want to make sure everybody understands, because the new strategy that's been announced puts us in for the long haul. Essentially what it says is that we'll treat Pakistan and Afghanistan as one theater. Makes a great deal of sense. In Pakistan, we will spend money in order to help them build both their military and their civilian government and infrastructure, on the theory that only a strong, unified Pakistan can resist the people who are our enemies building terrorist camps on their territory. In Afghanistan, the idea is the same, but we have to start with increasing U.S. troops so that we provide short-term security. That may be 1, 2, 3, 4 years, and then try to build the infrastructure within Afghanistan, the government infrastructure. This makes a great deal of sense from a counterinsurgency standpoint, but it is important to understand that this commits us to the long haul, an expense in blood, an expense in treasure. This is way beyond just nation supporting. This is nation building at its most fundamental. And if it works, then they'll throw us out. I mean, the whole idea is let's make the country strong enough to support themselves. And when that happens, they'll immediately ask us to leave. And I just think people ought to understand that going in. How about you?
No, Dave, I agree with what you got to say there. And we'd like to hear what our listeners have to say about this issue and many other that we discuss here. You can send us email by just going to hlsinsideandout.org. Tell us what you think, what you want us to talk about on Homeland Security Inside and Out.
We're going to close out Homeland Security Inside and Out tonight by thinking about the subject of education in Homeland Security. To help us do that, we're talking with Glenn Woodbury, who's director of the Naval Postgraduate School's Center for Homeland Defense and Security. Glenn also served as the director of emergency management for the state of Washington for 6 years. Glenn, thanks for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you.
A number of people have told me they think it's unusual that perhaps the premier master's degree in Homeland Security in the United States is at the Naval Postgraduate School. How do those two things fit together, Glenn?
Well, the Naval Postgraduate School is actually a federal military installation. The Naval Postgraduate School has a long history. We've been around for about 100 years, primarily teaching military students. But when the events of September 11th occurred, there was certainly an opportunity and a need to look at the programs that were here at the Naval Postgraduate School and the growing need for graduate-level education for this new endeavor we're calling Homeland Security. And from that, the Center for Homeland Defense and Security was established in partnership with the Department of Justice and then the Department of Homeland Security.
Glenn, who gets to come to these programs out there?
It depends. Our master's degree program is only for local, state, and federal government employees. However, we have an executive leaders program that also includes the private sector. And we are primarily targeting mid to senior level managers and executives in the Homeland Security environment.
Well, neither one of those is necessarily military, so you have a lot of maybe primarily civilians in your program.
That's true. That's true. We are fairly unique here on the Naval Postgraduate School that our programs primarily focus on civilian government officials. We do have military in our classes from NORTHCOM, Army North, the National Guard, but we see them certainly as part of the overall Homeland Security enterprise, which is why they're included in the program as well. And each of our cohorts is designed to be as multidisciplinary, multi-jurisdictional, and multi-government levels as possible, because that's where Homeland Security is and where it should be, which is a collaborative and coordinated effort. And so we try and mirror that in our classrooms.
I'm frequently asked, geez, what would you teach about Homeland Security? What's in your academic program? So what is in your academic program, Glenn?
Well, we have 13 courses, and I'll try and remember all of them. But essentially, we talk to policy and strategy in Homeland Security, Introduction to Homeland Security, Critical Infrastructure Protection, Information Technology for Homeland Security, Intelligence and Information Sharing for Homeland Security, government from other countries, how they are addressing homeland security issues, terrorism, unconventional threats, as well as research methods and those other things that you would commonly expect in a graduate-level program.
Now, your people, if they're going to be government officials and emergency managers, they can't afford to move to the Naval Postgraduate for 2 years. How do they get the education from you?
Oh, absolutely. We recognized that early on, that the student population that we were trying to reach was by no means going to be able to leave their positions or their jobs or their jurisdictions for a full 15, 18 months that, you know, is normally required in an in-residence graduate program. We use a hybrid learning method where the students who come to our program are in residence for 2 weeks every quarter over 18 months. The rest of the time, they spend online in web-enabled learning environments where they're doing papers, projects, simulations, and collaboration forums. And generally, that entails about 20 to 30 hours per week while they're not here in residence.
Glenn, I've seen some great papers that have been produced out there. I have one on my desk right now. I just printed out a thesis from a captain from the fire department in New York City. How could our listeners get access to some of the great research that's being done out there?
Well, they can go to our website, www.chds.us, and all of our theses, with a couple of exceptions, are published for public consumption. So anybody can access our materials, the theses that are produced, as well as some of our other research products. We also have viewpoints, short interviews that are available through podcasts or streaming video, where they can see interviews of current leaders in Homeland Security talking about current issues. They can also look to our Homeland Security Digital Library, which has over 70,000 documents now vetted and housed in a digital format, pretty much online through password access.
And Glenn, I assume it's the same location if people want to find out about application. Give us that website again.
www.chds.us.
Glenn Woodbury is the director of the Naval Postgraduate School Center for Homeland Defense and Security. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Homeland Security Inside and Out is an educational program where we seek to bring in interesting guests, ask them important questions, and get out of the way and let them talk. This program is a collaborative effort of KAMU Radio in College Station, Texas, the Integrative Center for Homeland Security at Texas A&M University, and the Institute for Homeland Security in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Ed Haddon. Our executive producer is Penny Zint. More than 400 interviews with Homeland Security experts are available in our program archives at hlsinsideandout.org. If you're interested in learning more about Homeland Security, we suggest you access our online database called TEX, the Taxonomy for Education and Exploration, located at homelandsecurity.tamu.edu. TEX contains short summaries of more than 4,000 key documents in the field of Homeland Security, all aligned with the curriculum of the graduate program in Homeland Security taught at the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M. For better or for worse, Homeland Security is changing how our government relates to us and how we relate to our government. To learn more about these changes and how you can influence the future, join us again next week on Homeland Security, Inside and Out.
This program may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.